To be honest, one of the things that I think benefited me accidentally is I was an outsider. I was a soccer and tennis player. I played baseball until eighth grade. I was a very mediocre backup third baseman. So I didn't have like this path to the big leagues that really gave me a great context for the game. I'll never forget it. I got referred Curt Schilling after his last shoulder surgery when he was 41 years old. I remember rehabbing Schilling. It was in our original facility in Massachusetts. It was like 7:30 in the morning, and you know, he was like ramping up his throwing program, doing well, thinking about a comeback. And he's like, "You do PFPs?" And I'm like, "What's that?" Like, rolls his eyes, like, and like, God bless him. He was super patient.
I'm out of here.
He was wonderful to me. He was super patient, but he had to be like, "What? This guy knows a lot about shoulders and not much else." So like, I've always in the back of my mind, like, carried that. Like, I got to ask a lot more questions and do a lot more listening. And it always served me well early in a career. And here I am, you know, 17 years later, whatever it is, like, and it was the right decision to do that.
So. There might be some people listening that don't know what PFPs
yeah,
are,
right,
so I don't true. Want to be left to our pitchers fielding practice, right? Hitting yep. some balls back to them.
Need more of it.
Doing their stuff, but look, this is...
Go ramp it up 3 days a week at least.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you love it at first base, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
This is kind of, I don't want to say this is off topic, but because it's like, it's about coaching. It's about, we've talked about this too before, coaches that have the experience, right? And how much easier that is to maybe listen to them. I think this is a topic for debate because I feel like you see it more in the NFL, like where there's head coaches that weren't players or didn't play for very long. And just like you said, you play baseball till eighth grade, but we still trust you, obviously. But as a strength coach, we know you look at you, you're deadlifting on, and that's probably why you put it on social, right? So everyone knows that you can.
It's like a cold plunge, just yeah. to let everybody know I did it.
Yeah, you did. I know you did it, so like they know, we know you have the experience. Well, you've been there, right?
Yeah.
There's something about that. Like someone that's been there as a coach, as someone that hasn't. And it's like, I really hate to say that. For me, it was more comforting when they had been there, right? And it's not, I don't want to say I distrust someone who hasn't, but it's a really interesting topic to talk about. And I feel bad even like bringing that up, but like, what about the guys that haven't been there? Like for you, was it easier to listen to, learn from, you know, accept coaching from somebody that's done it before? You know, how long does it take to build that trust, right? Like, we're talking about building the trust.
If my strength coach isn't jacked and vascular, I'm having a hard time buying in, dude. I'm just like, nah, I can't buy in, buddy.
Cressy, a master in the strength and conditioning world, especially in baseball. But I mean, 2008, 2009. We go back a long ways.
A while, man.
Yeah, we go back a long ways. And you know, we're introduced through an old teammate of ours, Matt Maurizio. He was training with you in Hudson, Mass, where it all started, right?
Yeah.
I mean, now you're almost worldwide, essentially. I know you're down here in Jupiter with your facility, and we'll get into all that. But we go back a long time. I was at his wedding. That was more. Yeah. That was more happenstance. A little bit.
It worked out well.
It was like I was in the area training, and I don't know if someone bailed or something, but I ended up at the wedding, and I had a great time. Kenny Bunkport. Man, Kenny Bunkport. That's the first time I went to Kenny Bunkport, and like that name stuck in my head. But I had a great time at the wedding. I loved your programs. I would train from afar at first, right? He'd just send these things over at very low cost at the time.
Cressy for me, West, which right?
was, yeah, Cressy West style. So I was on the West Coast training. He would send them over. Actually, that was before. So. I'll tell that story a little bit. We trained on the West Coast, even though Cressy was in Hudson, Mass. But we created a funny, that's kind of where my video career started. Really? Actually, one of the first was we created Cressy West. Cressy West was a complete spoof on what he did over there, especially his like powerlifting, because this guy can deadlift a ton. We can look up the numbers. I'm sure it's over 600 pounds or more these days. But we've had one guy in like a surfing suit. Because he would put on this, what is that called that you wear?
It was like a singlet for powerlifting.
Yeah, like a singlet for powerlifting. We were goofing on, we put on like a wetsuit, and the guy was like doing the deadlift. It was so funny. We could pull that up later or show another time. But I mean, that's how far back we go. I lived with you for a couple months training, and it's the best experience of my life, man, as far as getting into a situation to be strong and powerful in my sport, right? And you're doing it for a lot of people now, a lot bigger than me. And like I said, he was, but really helping the young guy at the time, which I really much, very much appreciated, got me to where I was. But I mean, who the guys you work with now are pretty impressive.
Well, thanks.
I mean, you can tell me.
Well, I think, I mean, to your point, like small hinges swing big doors, right? You never know which 29th rounder is going to be a big leaguer someday. So you try to treat everybody with that same care and treat them as if they're your own kid and put them in the best position possible to make them successful. But I think maybe what we did well early on, you know, in hindsight, you know, I look back at what we did training-wise 15 years ago, I'm like, gosh, we're so much better now at, you know, understanding how to individualize more. But I think back then what we recognized was that it was a very underserved population. You know, you had baseball players that just got the football workout and other ones that kind of got the foo-foo rehab program. And no one ever appreciated that, you know, you could push guys incredibly hard in that middle road as long as you understood their unique demands and, you know, what was unique about how their body moved and stuff. So I think in a way we were kind of first to market to that, and it served us really well early on. And you were an awesome guinea pig. So
I was guinea pig. And what was interesting about it was because at the time it wasn't having an outside trainer out of your organization wasn't like that cool. You know, like it was like, you know, you train with us. We're this team. We're that team. Like we have our strength coaches. But I was trying to pull his in on the side, so I actually had to talk to like Stoney with the Royals and be like, man, I really want to do this. I think it's working for me. And he was great about it, which was awesome. But I think that was about that time where it started shifting. It's like guys are on their own programs in the off season and they could bring this in and still succeed. And what didn't have to be that team's way, right? Which I think is pretty open nowadays. I mean, you tell me.
No, it definitely is. And I think that's something that I learned in my big league career. It was like when I debuted in 2011, strength and conditioning really, really started taking off. And it was like, all right, when you go home in spring or when you go home at the end of the season, you need to be ready to go in spring. We're not using spring to get ready. You got to be ready to roll. So, and I have a similar story of, you know, I started working with my guy down here, Scott, BioCore, shout out to BioCore. If I didn't mention him in this, he would have got pretty upset about that. So I had to throw him in there. But it was, we would work out to get strong. We would lift weights and do that. And over the course of time, we adapted and understood, you know, baseball is different. Like your muscles can't be tight. We can't have you blow out and miss 2-3 weeks. It's going to hurt the team. It's going to hurt you individually. It's going to hurt all that. So like at what point with Cressy, and it's known on a national level now, so congrats to that. At what point did you guys start making that like, all right, we got to adapt now. Like it's more than about getting strong. We got to get some movements in and all that type of stuff.
Yeah. So I'll say there's probably two big adaptations that came in. One is from a pure business standpoint. And then two is probably more on the methodology side of things is this is interesting. We were thinking about doing the second facility. So we've been in Hudson, Massachusetts, like, you know, Tim Collins was like an OG, like, and
that's right.
We would always joke that my business partner, Pete, you remember Pete Dupree, Pete always had like what we call Pete time. Right, so that we opened a little bit later up in the north. We'd be like, guys roll in at like, you know, the facility would open at 12. So like 9:30, 10, he'd be in the office getting work done. And Timmy would roll in with like his coffee and his breakfast. He'd sit there and he'd call it his peak time. And over the years, like we had more of these like local guys, mostly minor league guys, but you'd have some big league guys that were in there. And I'll never forget it. We were starting to think about doing a second facility in 2013. And Pete and Tim Collins and AJ Pollock were sitting in his office and kind of just talking about stuff. And I got in, and so the four of us were right there. And Brandon Gomes, who's now the Dodgers general manager, Brandon's in Fall River, Massachusetts. He was in town to kind of do his initial avows with us and kind of like poked his head in the door. He's like, hey man, like I heard about this Pete time. Can I get in on this? I'm like, yeah, man, it's just a bunch of dudes drinking coffee in the morning.
Like Diamond Dogs.
Yeah, make t-shirts.
Yeah, you probably remember the Gomes from Tampa Bay, right? And so he walked in and Brandon's amazing, but we were having kind of this conversation as we worked through it where we were discussing the idea of opening a second location in someplace warm weather. And he stopped me in my tracks. He's like, why wouldn't you? He's like, guys are all reading your stuff on their iPad in the clubhouse every night. He's like, they're just not crazy like me. They're not coming to Hudson, Massachusetts in January when it's freezing cold outside. He's like, they want to be warm weather. They want to be with their girlfriends and their wives. And it was like an epiphany for me. It was like, no matter how good the training we have is, we will never have regular big league clientele. Guys that move their families, spend entire off seasons with us. We'll get more of this 2-day visits, then do remote programs. And so it was kind of the kick in the pants I needed to be like, we're going to
be where
this.
They are, right?
Yeah. And we were fortunate. Steve Cishek was a long-term client. We had some guys that were on the ground in Jupiter. So we realized, you know, you kind of have four options if you want to go warm weather on the East Coast. You have Fort Myers, you have Tampa, you have Orlando, and you have kind of Jupiter West Palm. And so we kind of scouted them out, and Orlando was kind of trending in the direction of not being a spring training complex. And since then, the Astros have left, the Braves have left. So you really had Tampa, Fort Myers, and Jupiter. And we fell in love with Jupiter really quickly and had some guys there. And so the rest is history. We were fortunate. The Astros Nationals opened their complex there not long after we started out. So it was kind of right place, right time. But the second part of it is we realized, to your point, like, it's not just about being a strength coach. Like, baseball now is so much different than 07 when we started, because you basically have a situation where you have to have hitting guys. You have to have pitching guys. You know, we have three physical therapists. You have massage therapists. You have analysts. Like, all the pieces have to fit together. And if you're just like a strength coach banging weights, it doesn't work. So there has to be a pretty aggressive pivot, because anybody can get strong. And I think what we've seen historically is you see these guys that go to Division I weight rooms. You know, they put on 25 pounds in their first 2 years there. They get way better. You start hitting the ball harder, throwing harder, running faster. And then year three, they all get worse. They all get more banged up because they're doing the same program that the freshman is. And where we've had a lot of success is guys come into pro ball. They start up with us, and all of a sudden, it's like, hey, let's attack some of the movement competencies. Let's work on rotational capacity. Let's teach you how to sleep, how to eat, how to recover, and make, you know, use of all this information that's out there. It's not that getting strong is important. It's not that being powerful is important. But really, the research shows, like, pro guys actually aren't inherently that much more powerful than college guys. They're just way better at baseball. So I think we've been able to emotionally separate ourselves from the fact that we're strength coaches. We like getting people strong. It's more about figuring out, you know, what does Anthony, what does Eric need? What's the next play?
Now, while there are a lot of different, obviously, every person is different, are there any basic fundamentals, some basic first principles where it doesn't matter who you are, what level you are, you got to get these parts right? What would you, are there any of those? And
I always say, think upstream, right? Like, it's nutrition, sleep. Like, you take care of those two things, you're integrated. You look at any guy who's played late into their 30s, you know, obviously, like, Tom Brady's kind of like the poster boy for this. It's like, you know, if you're willing to invest in that stuff, it has a massive trickle-down effect. So I think all too often we're selling out for the really sexy things, like, you know, the new exercise we saw on Instagram. I'm really lucky to be around, like, some really, really good athletes, not just through CSP, but also the stuff I do with the Yankees. And, like, some of the best players in the world, like, you've seen it. Like, they do the most boring stuff every single day, but they're willing to do that stuff. Nothing that would get a like on Instagram, but they'll do it really consistently. So I come back to sleep, nutrition, and then just, like, having a really high-quality warm-up every day, being, like, meticulous about what you need.
What you're saying, though, like, where does it start almost? Like, you are very strong on early specialization, not doing that, right? And foundational strength more so than anything. So, like, meaning it's not necessarily good to be so specialized in strength training when you're younger at a certain, what's your cutoff for that?
I think it's more like, you know, what we don't want to see are 12-year-old baseball-only kids, right? Especially pitcher-only. Like, we like to see guys that, I know you guys were just talking with George, right? You know, George's kids are great soccer players and great baseball players. Like, there's a guy whose kids grew up in major league clubhouses. He had every reason for them to specialize. It was the most convenient thing in the world. And they're still out playing soccer at a really high level. And I think it served them well. So I generally encourage guys at a young age, get exposed to as many different things as possible. My own daughter's, like, softball, gymnastics, soccer, like, they're doing a million different things on a daily basis. And they might not be the best at any of them right now, but I know that they're building a broad foundation so that when the day comes, they're going to be able to pick what the best thing is for them, if there is only one.
I see a lot. I just saw on Instagram, which maybe last week. I mean, obviously can't believe everything you see on Instagram, but there was a professional athlete, NFL athlete, and he was talking about not specializing early. He's grateful for his gymnastics and all the different sports he played. And then you go into the comment section, and then you see the people who agree, and then you have some people who throw out, well, what about Tiger Woods? What about Venus and Serena Williams? What do you say to those people who were like, well, not necessarily, because look at all of these other people who specialized and they need to. And so how do you speak to that camp?
It's funny, because those N of ones get sensationalized. For every one of those, there's 100,000 kids that hate their dad. You know, like, that's honestly, unfortunately, the truth is that we see way more kids that wind up in orthopedic surgeons' offices and, you know, dealing with chronic overuse, and we see it on a daily basis. It's honestly really, really sad, because the research actually is super compelling that it doesn't work. Like, the better path is to actually diversify, you know, early on and then specialize at a later date. And you can look at, like, you know, they did a like study a couple of years ago on like number of players in the Super Bowl and how many of them were multi-sport athletes. It's insane. And you could probably speak to this better than everybody. There are a lot of late bloomers in the big leagues.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Tim Collins was probably the best example. He didn't get single division one offer.
He said he was throwing 78 miles an hour in high school, and from 18 to 20 years old, he's throwing, you know, 90-something miles an hour. But to me, that's like an endless debate, because you can go on and on. I can find one guy that's one sport. You can find one guy. But I think what separates some of the guys, especially what you do, is the fact that you individualize it. You get your assessment.
Yeah.
Everyone's different. You might need to go outside and run to get going off. You might need to be on the training table and get stretched out for an hour and a half. So, like, to me, it's like figure out who you are and what you need. And then that's how you kind of build your routine and you learn and all that type of stuff. So it must be so cool for you, too, because now you're at the point where you got some big time guys going in there, the Scherzers, the Verlanders, that these guys are in discussion for some of the best of all time, Hall of Famers, that type of stuff. So you got to get great feedback from those guys on a day-to-day basis.
I love it. I get more opportunities to be the dumbest guy in the room. Like, sometimes you sit back and you listen. I think we're always craving that, like, especially my name's on the facility. Like, the expectation is like, you're always going to have the answer, always have the final word and stuff. So I embrace the opportunity to kind of sit back and learn. What I think has happened more organically over the years of the facility that I've really appreciated is like the mentorship, where, you know, you see a Scherzer take a Jesus Luzardo under his wing, or, you know, just guys talking about, hey, this worked for me against this hitter. It might not work for you because this is your pitch mix. So I get just as excited about like our younger up and comers, you know, the Reed Detmers, the Tristan McKenzie's, a lot of those younger guys that are doing some really cool things in the game and are about to take that next step forward.
What I think is cool about how it, with his success too, is I feel like you have a terribly scientific brain, right? I don't know how much you guys have read.
Yeah, when you're talking about the dumbest guy in the room.
Yeah, I don't know if I believe he's throwing out all these big words. Like, I'm like, well, I don't know what you're saying, but it sounds like you know what you're talking about. And that's what, like, I think a lot of guys can trick you into as strength coaches, like throw out all these big words. I'm all scientific and I can tell you how the body works. He's not tricking you, for one, with that. Like, terribly smart when it comes to like biomechanics. I don't even know if I'm using the right words, biomechanics or whatever it is. But he humanized it too, right? Like, so you know he's terribly smart, and I want to get into how you got out to the world, and I think that's how you did it. But you come in the gym, and it's not like he'll give you the analytical side of it, of why it works for your body, which I think is awesome, and I think a lot of athletes want. But also, you have the weekend warrior in there that you're able to communicate with, right? And then, like you said, you put everything around it with the therapies and everything within in your facility, and you really did create the CSP family, right? And that's hashtagged on the wall. Like, it's been like that since day one, which I think is cool. So he not only had this immense like knowledge of how to get it right, but then bringing it to like to humans, because I think that's another level of intrigue that it brought me in, for sure. I was like, oh man, he's telling me things I never even heard about before. But you started, and I'm appreciative of this as a content guy, right? Creating media and different assets all over, trying to get information out to the world. You started as a blogger. I mean, you became viral in a sense of, you know, a video these days, but through your blogs, you were putting out daily. I mean, for how many years?
A long time.
Grind, right? And you're still grinding, doing podcasts and stuff. But I mean, tell me about how far back the blogs go.
I was fortunate. So my mom actually taught high school English. She was the curriculum coordinator in my hometown in high school, and then became principal. So I grew up, you know, basically around books, writing, reading, all that stuff for an extended period of time. So it to some degree came a little bit more naturally to me, I think, just because of that worm. I've always been much more articulate as a writer than I have as a speaker. I had to work really, really hard to do presentations and things like that. Even being in front of like groups as a coach, like, I was never really comfortable with that. I had to work at it really, really hard. But I always found that writing was just a way to clearly organize my thoughts. And so for me, I kind of started writing more so to help understand things, kind of like being in grad school, writing papers to dig in really deep on a topic. And then you realize you can write a lot more when it's something you actually enjoy. Like, yeah, I'm doing a paper on, you know, insulin independent glucose uptake. Like, that's not really enthralling in the grad school years. But when you start talking about, you know, shoulder range of motion and how it relates to a baseball pitcher, that's a little bit more compelling in your own internal narrative, I guess. So I just started doing more thinking aloud stuff and started my newsletter in 2001, just writing every day. And it's like anything else. taking BP or ground balls or anything like that. Eventually, it just becomes very second nature to kind of continuously produce content. What I didn't realize then was, yes, it was, you know, I was being compensated for the writing and stuff, but what I didn't realize then was that it was also creating a foundation for the facility, because I think in any world, you know, there's like the law of repeated exposures, right? So like, you know, you came down here from New Jersey, right? Maybe you left your house and you drove past a Dunkin' Donuts, you didn't buy a coffee, right? And then you got to the airport, you saw a Dunkin' Donuts, you didn't buy a coffee. You got on JetBlue and you know, they offered you Dunkin' Donuts, you didn't take one. Like, you have all these exposures on a daily basis. And, you know, there's different marketing research on how many exposures it is before you're just like not gonna purchase. Some people buy on the 12th exposure. I think that's different now than it probably used to be, just because people are checking their phone and they're getting bombarded with social media. What I didn't realize at the time was that that was another layer to give people an opportunity to not just perceive a marketing message, but to actually perceive our expertise. And what I realized over the years is we had people that wanted to come to the facility and just see the energy, make sure that it was a place where they could trust us to train their 15-year-old kid. That's a positive environment. Some people wanted to talk to another, you know, client that was more informed. Corey Kluber became a client because he was sitting in the Texas League stands next to one of our other guys who was charting pitches back in, I don't know, 2010, 2011, something like that. Everybody perceives your expertise in different ways. So if you're able to put yourself out there across more mediums, I think good things happen. I understand that now in the podcast and some of that stuff.
So it wasn't a plan.
No, it was not a calculated strategy. I just, writing came naturally to me, and it was a way to gather, express my thoughts. I do feel like from the get-go with our facility, we were always adamant, if we're not a training facility, we're a teaching facility. So I'm, you know, beyond just athletes, because I'm really proud of like where our interns and our former coaches have gone on to. So teaching is always just something that's been very near and dear to me in the context of like growing up in the family with a teacher and all that. So it kind of happened, but it served us well.
I like what you said. Just I forget exactly how you just said it, but your expertise would be perceived differently by different people. Yeah. Essentially, you were just talking about. Did you ever run into people? Sometimes you have people who are cheering for you as you're climbing up the ranks, but once you get to the top, they don't no longer cheer. They have haters. Yeah. Have you ever had these moments or any experience where somebody's like, oh, look at this guy just self-promoting, or he's branding himself, and with all the you're doing so much good for the industry, but some people might think you're hurting the industry, or maybe or jealous or envy. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but have you experienced that, number one, and how do you navigate that? Even some people saying, yeah, I don't, like almost wearing like a badge of honor. Oh, I don't do interviews. I don't post on Twitter. I don't do anything because I don't want to make it about me. Have you ever ran into
that? That's definitely out there. And I think it's probably worse. I think it's probably not as bad now than it was in the past, just because so many more people are out there. You know, it's easier to become a content creator than it ever was before, because when I started writing, like, Twitter didn't exist, Instagram didn't exist, I think Facebook was like in its infancy. So it really wasn't as easy to put yourself out there back then. So I think I probably got hit harder with it, probably circa 11, 12, 13. You know, some of the stuff you talked about is like, it was very unaccepted to be outside, you know, of baseball for your strength and conditioning coaches. So we had to do more work to build bridges and nurture relationships with those teams and all that stuff. But yeah, that's been there. I think where I got better at it coincided when I became a parent. You know, I just, arguing with people on the internet, it's a race to the bottom. I'd rather spend time with my kids give it to an athlete or, you know, someone, or volunteer at a charity, do any of that stuff that's just a better use of your time. Because usually the people that are angry about it, you know, they're just, you know, the higher up you go, the more hot air you're going to encounter. So
that's so true.
What is it? If you ain't got no haters, you ain't popping.
That's right. Tell me.
I feel like now it's more people on the internet that everyone's trying to find the new way. So it's probably like you have a lot of battles of kids coming in the gym being like, hey, did you see this guy on Instagram? Should I start doing this, or should I start slamming this ball or doing whatever it is? You know what I mean? So I almost feel like, yeah, that's more of like, dude, just trust what you need and let's continue on your path and all that. One thing I was going to ask you, but you kind of answered it yourself there. You know, we mentioned superstars like Telly and Maurizio that you had in the early come-ups and stuff. But so much of it's word of mouth. Yeah. I mean, you go into big league clubhouses and you hear Cressy. Yeah. You hear the drive lines. You hear all these different facilities that are on a national level. Who were like some of those big-time players that really like got you going? Or was it, do you credit the blog and do you credit that following online? I'm sure it's a mixture of both.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. I was at March 31st, 2011. Was that your major league debut, opening day?
Yeah.
I was there for Timmy's, right? So that was a breakout year for us. It was really helpful for a couple of reasons. One, you know, 5'7" guy, made it to the big leagues, like doing crazy athletic stuff, you know, 40-inch vertical jump, all this. That was really big for us. It also coincided, I think they said the 2011 draft was the best draft since 1986. And Massachusetts was actually ranked as like the fifth best state in the country. So you had this tiny state that had all these, Tyler Beattie went 21st overall. And there were a number of guys that trained with us that all got drafted. So we had a really compelling like 5'7" guy who made it to the big leagues. And, you know, I remember I went out to dinner with Timmy after his major league debut that night. And he was like trending on Twitter, and Torrey Hunter came over and gave him a big handshake at the Cheesecake Factory in downtown Kansas City. And, you know, at the same time, we had this big draft class that year. So it really put us on the map. You know, so there were, you know, it's kind of like the, I guess, the 80-20 rule, 20% of your clients lead to 80% of your referrals. So, you know, C-Sheck was another one. I know you played with Steve on Team USA. Mm-hmm. You know, Steve was just one of those guys. I asked him, I was like, hey, man, you've played, you know, Miami, you played in St. Louis, you played in Chicago, you played in Seattle, Anaheim, the Rays. Like, I lose track of every place. He finished up with the Nationals, and literally everywhere he goes, we would get referrals. I was like, what is it? Like, people find you to be just a wonderful human. They want to be where you're being. He's like, I don't know, you know, if this is it, but he's like, I've just tried to serve anywhere I've gone. And he's very devout in his faith and, you know, just a wonderful guy. And like, you know, when you see like an accomplished big league closer goes out of his way to like spend time to the fringe 40-man guy or the first year draft guy or anything like that, they start to ask questions about how does a guy have this much success and be this approachable. So Steve's probably been one of our biggest referral sources, and my neighbor and our kids hang out together now. So it's cool that I get to continue to experience that, like that servant mentality, you know, after the fact. But I think, you know, to your point, like there were a few guys that really did move the needle for us.
So cool, because you watch it happen organically in a clubhouse, and this guy's got 10 plus years in the big leagues, and it's like, man, like, you're durable, man. You're, whenever we need you, we're out there. And then I see what you're doing before, I see how your day is, and like, as an older player the last couple of years, I enjoyed seeing different guys' routines and how they would get ready, and I had a whole new appreciation for that. But a guy like Steve, he takes the young guy under his wing, and he goes that much farther with it, and he's like, listen, man, this is how you got to prepare. You got to be ready for this. You got to be ready for that type of situation. So I can see how people see what he does and want to follow suit and then take it to that next level in the off season and continue it all the way through.
I think you can probably speak to this better than ever. It's really hard to compete at that level, but to compete at that level and mentor younger guys. There's a book called The Captain Class. It looked like the best 25 teams of all time. And they looked at like Pele's Brazilian national team and all this stuff. And like, they talk about like Pele wasn't a team captain. Jordan wasn't a team captain. Like, very rarely is the best player also the captain. And, you know, sometimes like that veteran bullpen arm is the guy that changes a 23-year-old's career. So I'm always so fascinated, like, at just how mentors play, and not just in baseball, but in various roles, because I've been fortunate to see a lot of them do cool things.
You have to have some people that kind of lift you up through this process. And I know some names, but I want to hear from your perspective what they did for you, because I think it's really cool how you become respected in their eyes, but obviously they helped get you to where you are.
Yeah, there's a few. I was really lucky. I went to the University of Connecticut for my grad degree. And I left undergrad not really knowing what I wanted to do. UConn was great. It was like the number one kinesiology grad program in the country. And it's like a super low acceptance rate. But I didn't know whether I wanted to be a researcher, whether I wanted to like get into coaching, anything like that. And I got to UConn, and I'd been doing a little bit of writing in this space. And Brijesh Patel was a graduate assistant strength coach there. And he's like, hey, I read some of your articles online. They were awesome. He's like, I'm not sure if you have an interest in strength and conditioning, but like, hey, I have men's baseball strength and conditioning tomorrow morning at 5:30. He's like, come on by. It was almost like he was testing me. Like, would he actually show up? I showed up, and you know, I watched, and it was like, just fell in love with like how he controlled the room, you know, the relationships he had with his players, just things, nuanced things, using their name when he coached, how he positioned himself, the body language. Like, I was immediately fascinated by that. Maybe it's from growing up around teachers, like body language is everything. Instantly caught the strength and conditioning bug. And I was lucky at UConn at the time. Chris West really took me under his wing. He was a strength coach there who did men's, women's basketball, men's, women's soccer. Andrew Hootie was there, Tina Murray, and all these folks have gone on to do, you know, amazing things. Tina's with the Pittsburgh Penguins now. So they all gave me like a foot in the door, and I got to work with, you know, four number one teams in the country between 2003 and 2005 while I was doing my grad degree. And it was like, I wasn't even in really baseball. It was actually working more in basketball and soccer. But but they gave me a really important opportunity. Actually, it's cool. Brijesh now, he went on, he was the National Strength and Conditioning Association Strength Coach of the Year last year for Quinnipiac. They won the national championship in men's hockey. So pretty cool to see how it come full circle.
A lot of players, they have their guys. They have their own strength and conditioning guy. They have their own hitting guy, some cases dietitian or so forth. And then the organization, obviously you have your in-house strength and conditioning coach, your nutritionist. How do you, as if you're not with an organization, how do you work with players? How does that work? Let's say I'm a player and I'm like, my organization head coach, strength and conditioning coach, is wanting me to do this program, but the guy or the girl that I work with on the side is like, no, this works. Like, how does that communication, that dynamic even work from your perspective and your perspective?
So a lot of it is when we talk about you got to individualize it. If there's conviction behind what you're doing is the right thing for you, and you have the numbers, you have the tests to prove it all, like, I'm going to buy into that 100%. And I think this was early, I think a lot of organizations have really adapted to this, but it was kind of a one size fit all, one plan for everybody. And I'm a big hitting first baseman. I shouldn't be doing the same workout as a base stealing center fielder. We live different lives. Our value is different on what we bring to the field. So like, we got to train a little different. Overall, maybe you're going to do a lot of stuff similar, but you're going to do some different things as well. So to me, because of the conviction and the studies and the numbers and the data, that lets me know I'm doing the right thing 100%, and I'm going to buy into that.
Mm. Mm.
I think that's an amazing point. Like, at the end of the day, it's just, you got to bring them together. If you're the player, right? And I've been on both sides of it, obviously, from my role in professional baseball and then the private sector. In professional baseball, you know, you got a 40-man roster. The chances of all 40 guys being in one place in the offseason, it's impossible, right? They're all over the place, you know. You got guys that are international. You know, we have players in Nicaragua. We've had players in Japan. We've had guys that go all over the place. Like, for me, it's always been great to have people I can trust in the private sector that I can communicate with so that they're keeping tabs on guys. And, you know, maybe we send them home with, like, these are the things that I think would really help them. But, hey, you're with them day to day. Poetic license to do what you need to do to get the results there. And, you know, maybe there's a little bit less poetic license if there's a post-surgery scenario and we have, like, very specific timelines. For me, in the private sector, though, it makes us look good in the private sector if they have a great in-season. So it's to our advantage to nurture a relationship with teams to say, hey, here's where they're at coming back. So, you know, over the next couple of weeks, I have a lot of phone calls with teams on, like, we did this with them. It worked great. You know, here's some soft tissue work that I think would really help if you could relate it to the massage therapist or ATC. So I think it always comes down to communication. Fortunately, it's so much different, to your point, than it was 10, 15 years ago. Like, now, like, we're going to conferences with each other in the off season.
You've infiltrated.
It's so much, it's less insular than it was. Like, you can have those conversations organically. Like, you can just text the guy, and, you know, a lot of the players are, you know, they might be working off apps from their team. Like, we can just easily send programs to the teams. It all works way smoother than it used to. It used to be really hard.
Wow.
Yeah, organizations weren't really cool with you going outside of the organization for stuff, but I think everyone realizes now everyone wants the best for the player. So, like you're saying, let's collaborate and let's figure out what he needs to make him the best player or the best whatever he can be. And we both have our names, or we're on this guy. So let's go. Let's do that, you know?
The worst thing you can do is get surprised as a major league strength coach. You've seen it, right? You've seen it. There's going to be one guy on that 40-man roster that shows up and just does not look good. He did not do what he was supposed to that offseason, whether it's because he went off the grid or he, you know, did his own program, whatever it was. And that's a lonely place, because you're like, opening days in 6 weeks, like, what do we do? Like, we can't just push the season back for you, and you have to make some of these, you know, kind of hard conversations. That's why it's to the team's benefit to have, you know, a point of contact beyond just the player in the offseason to always know kind of what's going on.
Good point.
I love that. I wish it was that easy when I was there. It's always like managing that, like, I don't want you to feel bad. I'm training outside there, but I don't want you to feel bad, because, like, I really like what you're doing. It's been a lot of baseball, right? We've talked about all these baseball teams. Even when you got into this, you ran into a guy that was doing baseball strength and conditioning, but you don't just do baseball, right? There's a lot of other sports you deal with. And you know, the most I think about is tennis being more of that throwing motion, but what other sports have you infiltrated as well?
Yeah, we actually do a lot in terms of tennis, golf, actually quite a few NFL quarterbacks as well. So it's kind of spread in those markets as well, particularly because of kind of the overhead / rotational, emphasis. But we see a little bit of everything.
That's really where you started. It was like rotational shoulder stuff, right?
Yeah.
That's where, like,
took off.
That was the wheelhouse for sure. So it's kind of gradually expanded. But, you know, it's fun. I was a tennis player growing up too. So getting back to our roots a little bit with some of that has been good. It hasn't helped my golf game at all, but you know, we can all hope, right? Yeah.
Jupiter's a good area for
that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's cool. Is there anything that, after all your experience, anything that you disagree with now that you used to believe? Is there anything that, like, you may you be used to teach it?
Yeah.
And then over experience, you look back, you're like, yeah, I absolutely disagree with what that
approach.
Yeah,
I think, you know, one of the things, maybe piggybacks a little bit on something we talked about, is that it's really easy to get athletes strong. Anybody can do that. Unfortunately, sometimes you're learning a lot of strength on some bad patterns, or you're selling out for it. I mean, baseball weighs 5 ounces. You don't need to be freaky strong. Like, I'm sure Mookie Betts ain't, you know, back squatting 500, like, and he's still hitting a baseball really hard and doing incredible things on a baseball field. So I think it's about understanding what each athlete needs. But I think just in general, like, there is a point where they're strong enough. And I think maybe my threshold for what it is lower down than it used to be. So now it's a lot more velocity-based training, a lot more things. Now that we have really good objective measures to quantify, like, how usable your force characteristics really are.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good. No, it's so neat. There's a phrase I heard, having strong beliefs loosely held. Yeah. And when you have data to support that, evidence that, oh, okay, I'm wrong. Or the way we're approaching it is no longer valid, or hey, the things have changed, or maybe it doesn't work for this person. That's really cool.
I'm sure that's no different in your field.
Yeah.
Right? Like, just figuring out ways to approach people or work on these processes, and you look back. I mean, I guess it's like that in any field. I look back at some of the videos I've made in the past, and I'm like, man, that could have been a little bit better. I could change the way I'm doing it.
Yeah.
But like, what's the crossover? Right, so now that you know more about Cressy, right, and then sitting in your seat.
Yeah, I'm fast. I want to
hear
you. So the thing that really intrigues me about you, so I listened to a podcast that you did with Tim Ferriss, and I was telling the guys, I heard a couple of podcast interviews that you've done, been wonderful, but I was listening to your podcast with Tim Ferriss, and you were speaking in a language, I was like, I don't even understand what he's saying. I don't even know these terms, or what does he mean? But then you listen to a different podcast, and it's very easy to understand and so forth. So you knew your audience so well, and I think very similar. And players, it's that you can sniff out a fraud. Like, if you try to fake the funk with a player, a professional athlete, a lot of people, professional, they will.
They sniff you out, or you're sniffing them out?
They sniff the professional out. They will do everything they can to test the circle of competence of whoever, whatever person they're working with, to see, let me see how much you know, and let me push back on you. Players are really good at doing that, because they want to know that this person has competence. The commonalities that I'm noticing is, with your vast education and your understanding of what you do of the body, and even understanding the language, it sounds like to win over and to build a relationship, you're not coming to Scherzer with jargon. You're not coming to these players as a status signal how smart you are. You're building this language, probably using a language that's common language, that's their language, hearing how they describe it, and using very similar to this. We're not talking prefrontal cortex and hypothalamus and working memory. They don't care about any of that stuff. It's like, hey, just slow the game down. Here's a simple little strategy. And so I'm hearing, from what I'm listening, it's like there's a difference between a coach who keeps things simple, and the only way you can keep things simple is if you know your topic so well. So it's on the backside of complexity. You understand the nuances of complexity that you can keep it simple. Some people are too simplistic, or they try to keep it simple, but they don't understand the complexities, so they don't really know the nuances. And as I'm listening to you talk, I'm like, oh yeah, it's like, it sounds like, yes, you know your stuff, but you can teach in a way so simple that they not only understand it, but cannot misunderstand it.
That's the goal. You're trying to close the gap on what you know and what you can actually implement, right? And I can read 800 books, but none of it's going to actually impact an athlete favorably unless I can relate it in a way that they understand. So using big words, overwhelming them, that's not good for anybody, particularly in obviously a sport like baseball, where you have a lot of players where, you know, English may be a second language, and they might not pick up on the nuances of it or anything like that. So I've had to really, I think, consciously check myself on that side of things over the years, because you got to be careful. Like, you go and you talk to a bunch of physical therapists at a seminar, and then you're dealing with an 18-year-old athlete that might overwhelm them. But to be honest, one of the things that I think benefited me accidentally is I was an outsider. I was a soccer and tennis player. I played baseball until eighth grade. I was a very mediocre backup third baseman. So I didn't have like this path to the big leagues that really gave me a great context for the game. I'll never forget it. I got referred to Curt Schilling after his last shoulder surgery when he was 41 years old. I remember rehabbing Schilling. It was in our original facility in Massachusetts. It was like 7:30 in the morning, and you know, he was like ramping up his throwing program, doing well, thinking about a comeback. And he's like, "You do PFPs?" And I'm like, "What's that?" He like, rolls his eyes like, and like, God bless him. He was super patient.
So I'm out of here.
He was wonderful to me. He was super patient, but he had to be like, "What? This guy knows a lot about shoulders and not much else." So like, I've always in the back of my mind, like carried that, like, I got to ask a lot more questions and do a lot more listening. And it always served me well early in a career. And here I am, you know, 17 years later, whatever it is, like, and it was the right decision to do that.
So. There might be some people listening that don't know what PFPs
yeah,
are,
right.
So that's I don't true. Want to be left to our pitchers fielding practice, right? Hitting yep. some balls back to them.
Need more of it.
Doing their stuff, but look, this is...
Go ramping up 3 days a week at least.
Yeah. You love it at first base, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
This is kind of, I don't want to say this is off topic, but because it's about coaching. It's about, we've talked about this too before, coaches that have the experience, right? And how much easier that is to maybe listen to them. I think this is a topic for debate because I feel like you see it more in the NFL, like where there's head coaches that weren't players or didn't play for very long. And just like you said, you play baseball till eighth grade, but we still trust you, obviously. But as a strength coach, we know you look at you, you're deadlifting on, and that's probably why you put it on social, right? So everyone knows that you can. You know you can.
Like a cold plunge, just to let everybody know I did it.
You did it. So like they know, we know you have the experience. You've been there, right?
Yeah.
There's something about that. Like someone has been there as a coach, as someone that hasn't. And it's like, I really hate to say that. For me, it was more comforting when they had been there, right? And it's not, I don't want to say I distrust someone who hasn't, but it's a really interesting topic to talk about. And I feel bad even like bringing that up, but like, what about the guys that haven't been there? Like for you, was it easier to listen to, learn from, you know, accept coaching from somebody that's done it before? How long does it take to build that trust, right? Like we're talking about him building the trust.
If my strength coach isn't jacked and vascular, I'm having a hard time buying in. I'm just like, nah, I can't buy in, buddy. But for me, it's like the work and relationship you have, and we talked about every guy's different. You talked about a language. So for me, it's like the longer that relationship is, some guys want all the information. Hey, your ground force plates, you generated this. We need you to lay it off a little bit or whatever. And like your biggest fear as a strength coach is probably taking away from the athlete. Yeah. So for me, I was like goal oriented. Like if I needed to rotate my hips more, give me a medicine ball and tell me to hit this side of the cage. And I'm going to give it everything I got. But like sometimes when I had too much information, and in a day and age now where we have so much information, I bet that's a fine line of like, all right, I want to explain this, especially to these young cats, but I don't want you to be robotic and take away from that athlete.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to be analytical and competitive at the same time. It just doesn't work. There have to be, I mean, you can speak to that probably more than anybody else. It's just, it's a very fine line. I think it's, we see it a lot when guys go AAA to the big leagues. The minor leagues is very manicured, right? Every Monday is off. Like, you know, all these guys get like, you know, a Thursday or Friday off just to make sure that they're not getting beat up 6 days in a row. And you can just throw all this information at them because it's developmental. All right, your changeup's terrible. Go throw it 40% of the time until it gets better. Like, you know, it's fail forward. Like in the big leagues, if you fail, you go back to AAA. So I think a lot of guys really, you know, they have to recalibrate when they get to the big leagues. Particularly, I mean, the travel schedule is more intensive, the stress of it all. Like sometimes you got to understand how to like pull back and not like take in so much information, do so much work, like to actually like, I don't want to say save your bullets, but that's kind of what it is.
Mm-hmm. What's the next position you guys think will be implemented? Like we have strength coaches, we've had them for a long time. We have mental health coaches maybe now process and skills and development. Like, is there something else that surrounds this that you could forecast?
Teams that have hired sleep coaches.
I was just going to say that.
There you go.
I was just
like, say you that. Have a trip to London this year. How are we going to go about it?
Yeah.
And that's one thing to me that adds to that baseball grind is like sleep and nutrition. It's huge. But you might have that night game. The Yankees are going to be in prime time and you're flying from New York to Toronto and you're going to get in at 3 a.m. and you got to go the next day at 7. So it's like, you're not going to get optimal sleep. So how do you go about that? Is there a routine you get to every day that
did you talk to the sleep coach? Have you worked?
Yeah, and it was meetings and spring training because we were going to London, and it was basically prep for that. How are we going to get it going? How are we going to try and change our internal clock and basically get the most out of those 2 days while we're there? So that's something that I don't know if every team.
Yeah, like what was
did
the
you
process?
Guys do? Did you go to sleep?
Guys were dog tired, so I'm not trying to knock the guy. It was tough.
Lots of.
But my question is like for the teams that aren't going to London, you don't have a unique trip like that. Yeah. How do you deal with that? Like as a pitcher, it's easy. A pitcher in the big leagues is if you have a travel day, the day you're playing and that pitcher's pitching the next day, he's going to catch a commercial flight, get to the city, be ready to go. But you got a guy like Aaron Judge that you expect to be out there for 150-something games out of the 162. It's like, man, we got to figure this out, and we got to figure out how this works.
Yeah. It probably was the market of inefficiency like 5 years ago. I think it's becoming way more accepted to, you know, throw that under the sports science umbrella, and people are attacking that a lot more. Just like, you know, teams are scrutinizing blood work more than they ever have. They're looking at all these, you know, more nuanced things like, you know, for me, the two areas where I see the game potentially going very soon. One, I think scouting is going to be far more international than it's ever been. You know, it's traditionally been Latin America and a little bit in Japan. I think it's going to become much, much bigger. You see the NBA going to Africa more regularly. You see more players from Bahamas coming to the U.S. and being successful, more European players. I think we're going to see far more international influence in the game over the next 8 to 10 years. Australia, baseball has really taken a huge step forward there in recent years. So I think that's one. And I think the thing that piggybacks that is we need to help those players, you know, get adjusted to the United States. Like, you know, here's sort of thing. It was Carlos Carrasco, you know, was like, I ate pizza every day for 3 months because it was the only thing I knew how to order. They need to learn the language faster. And also we need to get them assimilated. Like, I know for me, like my biggest shortcoming as a coach is that I don't speak Spanish. Like it's something that would revolutionize my career. And I was sheltered. I was at a facility in Hudson, Massachusetts, and I grew up in Maine. There's not a whole lot of Spanish speaking taking place. So that's something that, you know, I've had to work on, but I think we need to do more to help those players get, you know, assimilated quicker, just because, you know, the more we can get them adjusted, the faster we can help them to develop.
I like what you said. And I love the question too. Immediately when you said, where's the next wave of kind of practitioners or helpers in organizations. So I'm just probably like yourself, I'm just having conversations with different NFL teams, NBA teams, NHL teams, and just kind of here reading the tea leaves. It looks like that the next wave is going to be this more focus and support and resources for the coaches. Yeah. To be able to, so there's an organization out there who's developing a coaching, teaching effectiveness. They want to enhance the effectiveness of the coaches to be better teachers. So they're bringing in these teaching experts to teach them how to speak, to teach them how to tell stories, to teach them how to ask questions. Because coaches are like, we've never been trained on any of this. There's an organization who wants to teach their coaches, hey, let's do a Spanish class for the coaches. Let's teach our coaches Russian if they don't speak Russian, so they can all to be able to help the players better, to be able to help teach more effectively. So I think that's going to be the next frontier, one of the next waves coming, where you're gonna see organizations put a little more money into the coaching development to help them maximize their ability to ultimately help the players.
You work with a lot of golfers too, right? And I feel like golfers have their own team that they build out, which might be like similar to what a team might build out eventually, but I feel like it's a little harder to bring it into a team aspect where an individual could be like, I want the sleep coach, I want this and that. And I feel like that's where you might see like almost trends starting when you have these individual people, individual athletes bringing in a team around them to figure out what they exactly need around them to be successful will eventually make it to the organizations when they open up to it or can find the money or place to put them, right?
Golf and tennis kind of necessitate that. You know, it's 40 weeks a year on the road. Like, you kind of have to have your people there to, like, you know, be ready if there's a, you know, you wake up with a stiff neck and you get treated before you go out and play 18. Like, it's, you know, I think it's a lonely on the road, but they can kind of bring their entourage with them and it, you know, supports a couple different ends.
Yep.
I think it'd be a detriment if we don't figure out with all this knowledge here of, like, what to give to the what knowledge to give out to the audience, right? Especially if we have youth players, athletes watching, which I hope we reach. There's got to be some sort of guideline or baseline that you might be able to put out there for shoulder health or body health. What in general is there somewhere I know we talked about like ages you might start at, but is there like a general piece of advice you can give them to get started with their strength and conditioning career or that part of their career to be successful on the field, that whether it's the youth athlete or the coach, the parents watching, can they get them started?
Yeah, for sure. The first thing, like we said earlier, play as many sports as possible, like grow up in the backyard, you know, bikes, balls, whatever it is that you have, friends, like that's the most important thing is free play. The problem with development is never the kids. It's always the parents.
I love that it's so like, just play.
Sports, it's, right? It's, I mean, it's kind of manicure. That happens quite a bit, unfortunately. But you know, people ask me all the time, like, when should I start strength training and all that? Is it going to stunt growth? Like, it's an old wives' tale. The research has, you know, shown over and over again that it actually has a really important place in like this whole developmental timeline. It actually can probably help. You know, you see these kids that, you know, they grow 6 inches in 6 months and they kind of go through that clumsy, awkward stage. Like having some strength in the right places can kind of ground them and give them a little better motor control of these new patterns that they have. So I always say like the most important thing you can do is just you integrate it when the kid is ready for it. So I have twin 9-year-old daughters. They come to the gym with mommy and daddy all the time. They're swinging from the TRX and they're, you know, doing like gymnastic stuff on the barbells and dragging each other in the sleds and stomping med balls. Like it's all very, you know, self-driven. Like they write their programs on the board and just go through it. We don't force it. But it's a Matt Maurizio line, more is caught than taught. So I try to just say, we're going to model that behavior. They're going to fall in love with it. And whether they become Olympic gymnasts or they just become, you know, girls who love to go to the gym, like they're going to foster a lifelong healthy relationship with exercise. So I'm really big on that. The problem is when you push too much too early, you wind up with a stress fracture, all of a sudden working out isn't fun anymore because it hurts or because you can't do the only workout that you've ever known. When kids can appreciate variety, it's like, if you get a growth plate injury in your shoulder, go play basketball for a few months and you come back for baseball season and it's going to be good to go. So they're very different approaches, but for me, it's all about playing that long game. So, you know, I go through this, like our daughters play 10U softball now too. And what's interesting is they were kind of like the average players on the team. They're undersized. Mom's 5'3", dad's 5'8". It's probably not going to be an NBA career for anybody. But like last year, they were on the team. There's a bunch of travel ball girls who, you know, go to Atlanta for tournaments and do all this stuff. You know, parents spend, you know, $1,500 to go get them 10 plate appearances, you know, three states away. And it doesn't make sense to me. All those kids quit travel ball. They're back playing just like rec ball by the next year. Just because an 8-year-old should not be traveling across the country just to find better competition when they could be getting it in the backyard or with their friends down the street. So I'm very big on like, don't force, you know, force development. It kind of happens as long as you set the guardrails and put them in a good position to be successful.
You started early, right? You were stout when you were little.
I was, dude. I was, but I played football in like the 8th grade and going through that stuff in football, it teaches you a different mentality. It teaches you just different stuff that you could use in baseball. But
different social group too. You're rolling.
Yeah, different, exactly. But I was a part of that awkward growth spurt group where I went from like 5'9" my 8th grade year to like 6'1". And I would run down the first baseline and I couldn't lift my leg up to like get like any kind of stride going. So I'm like, man, what is, but I just never grew into my body. And I trusted it. I just continued to play sports, do different type of stuff, hang out outside. And then at some point, it got a little more and more flexible and I became older and then the rest is history. But I agree with you 100%, man. Some of these parents out there, it's like, you gotta just, they want it more than the kid wants it. And like, let the kid grow into it. Let him get the love for the game and let him come to you. That's your mentality. Let him come to you. And then when that happens, as they get older and more mature, we can dial it down into one sport if stuff's looking like it's going to go that way.
And the funny thing about like the growth spurts, I talk to parents about this all the time, is like they think it's like a huge problem and all this stuff. It's a great time to train power. Like you're wound as tight as can be. Like you go from being 5'9" and probably like a little bit like uncoordinated, and all of a sudden you're like, maybe you don't have as much range, but you got like gazelle type springiness. So it's a great time to train power. They do a lot of that with like TPI in the golf world. It's like, hey, chase that growth spurt and use it as an opportunity to develop kids. It's just a great time to get involved.
You've coached a lot of coaches. You've had a lot of interns. What are some of those character traits that you look, that you feel are very important that a strength and conditioning coach, and I'm sure that we could even, the character traits you're about to say are like great for employees, great for parents, but what are some of those character traits that you try to really breed, or not breed, but instill into those who you hire?
Yeah, you know, I'll give you probably the best like lead into my answer. My answer is like growth mindset, curiosity. I asked that to Sam Fold. So Sam was one of our athletes when he played, you know, the general manager of the Phillies. Sam's first job after he retired was player information coordinator. So he was in the dugout with the Phillies, basically being the guy to disseminate high-level analytics to players in real time. And, you know, Stanford graduate, super bright guy, very articulate, very calculated in his words. I was like, you know, what made you such a good fit to, like, immediately go to a major league dugout? Because usually guys retire, they got to go spend a year at the complex, maybe hang out as an affiliate, hitting coach or something like that, and then they work their way back. And he's like, I've always just been curious. So I think when you have that curiosity, that unyielding desire to learn more, it comes across with a lot of humility. So I think those three things work really, really closely together. And we've had a lot of success with, you know, with staff members, interns, things like that, who are just genuinely curious. Because my name might be on the wall, but I want people who are going to challenge me and ask questions and think of ways that we can do things better. You know, we want this to be something that evolves each year, because we have athletes that come back and, you know, hey, this one's new from last year. We weren't doing this. What's the reason for this? And I love that they see there's a kind of a continual evolution of it.
That's really cool.
You definitely have to have that adaptability, right? Because everything continues to grow. And, like, I think that's what a lot of old school baseball players kind of fall into is, oh, the analytical stuff, I don't believe in this, whatever. But if you have that ability to adapt and understand it, you can learn from it. And it can help you communicate with different people. There's younger guys that come up now, and that's majority of what they know is the numbers. And so, like, if you have that ability to adapt and learn it and understand it, that can be a line of communication with a player, coach, with anybody. You know?
Oh, true.
Yeah, the game is, obviously baseball has changed dramatically even in the last, you know, 3 to 5 years, just in terms of, I mean, just looking at, like, guys are, you know, seam shift away. Guys are learning two-seamers on Twitter and they're throwing it the next day in a game. You see obviously the sweeper revolution. Like, these guys are able to pick up. It's honestly, unfortunately, benefited the pitchers way more than the hitters. But I think the game has changed. And honestly, strength and conditioning has been doing that for 15 to 20 years. Like, if you look back in the 80s, everything was like aerobic exercise research. And then they started looking at, like, resistance training as it related to chronic disease and how do we keep astronauts from wasting away in space flight. Like, it's still very much in its infancy how we make athletes better. And, you know, we get a ton of research on a weekly basis that's published. So you just, if you're not staying ahead of it, like, you're going to fall behind really, really quickly.
Mm. Yeah. Everyone always feels like on the baseball side, pitching is like 3 to 4 years ahead of the hitting.
Yeah.
And the hitters are trying to find ways to adapt to these new pitches, new stuff, whatever they got going. But there's definitely, like, there's a couple players that, like, evolutionized that stuff. Like, I remember in golf when Bryson DeChambeau just started mashing balls and created a whole new wave. So, yeah, it really is interesting stuff. And it's the guy to me that, like, the guy that had a good career, mediocre career, say, as a younger player, and then kind of found something in the later part of his career, to me, that's so impressive. You know what I mean? Like, you really have to study, you got to train, you got to do X amount of hours to be able to have your body fully adapt to that. Mm-hmm. So it's a game that just keeps getting, I mean, it's these longer careers that are happening now are more and more impressive because of how that adaptability, like we're talking about, everything's growing so fast.
The guys were throwing anywhere near what they're throwing now. When I was playing, I would have played 2 years max. Yeah. I'm telling you, it's crazy. Appreciate you, bro.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Thank you very much.
Thanks, dude.